as XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Tuesday, race fans. Sirius 162, XM 207, Sports Zone 999 if you're listening online that way, or on your remote device, or plugged in through the car dashboard. That's how I do it. A lot of times. Well, that way you get the full, you know, everything that's on the app, you can, right? Yeah, and it's SteveBick.com. I think a busy morning, at least a busy first half of the show. We've got a lot of ripped from today's headline type coverage to discuss, and that includes some Heisa-ing quite a bit. Actually, and timing ended up being very, very appropriate because yesterday Heisa released that group of 16 really interesting and eclectic next-gen type individuals that are going to be part of the advisory group that Heisa had put a call out for. And we'll talk to Lisa Lazarus about that and other topics of the day that have been front and center, let's put it that way, the last several weeks, including the Phil Schoenthal case, as discussed last week. And it was settled yesterday, and I'm going to include that in the conversation, obviously, with Lisa. And then Phil himself will follow Lisa's visit. And maybe, you know, maybe this is a transformative incident to some degree. Because if you saw Phil Schoenthal's quotes and you know, his reaction to how this was resolved, it's very interesting, and it features references to what Jonathan Wong dealt with his case and his suspension in terms of what Phil, you know, the resolution, 15-day suspension, which more than half has already technically been served, so he's got to sit out another week. But what's interesting is that Phil actually did not retain, at least as of the last time I talked to him, I think, which was Friday, he had not brought in outside counsel and was basically working with Alan Foreman and in sort of going back and forth between Alan and Phil. Alan said, you know, Phil's doing everything right the way he's handling this. And he went and tested his exercise riders and his staff and got, you know, had two positives come back, you know, meth tainted tests, and from every indication, you know, what Phil learned in reading through the Wong, you know, whatever filings, depositions, reports. He thinks he really found the right path in responding to Haiwu, and then was very satisfied after some real unsettling and upsetting several days. He came away very satisfied with how the process went down. So we'll let Phil walk you through it himself as a horseman having experienced this. And it'll be instructive or edifying or enlightening, one way or the other, for everybody, I think. So I'm happy that he's happy and that it's getting resolved. It doesn't it doesn't make this circumstance, these human drug scenarios, doesn't make them any easier, and it's not going to make them go away. But if everybody understands the mechanics, I suppose that's invaluable. So we'll let Lisa bring us up to speed on some of the things that have been going on. I've got a few different questions. We'll get an update on things like the laboratory harmonization. And, of course, they had the hiccup in Kentucky. Talk probably about where they are, how far along with the LASIX. They just started. It's only months. But this LASIK study that they were, as part of the authority, the institutionalization of the authority. So we'll see what's going on with that. And, that and also the this next gen group and lots of friends that are literally the next generation that are coming forward in the game. Our friend Joe Bianca and Nick Tamaro are going to be involved. You got young riders, Keith Asmussen, Tyler Gaffleone. How about that? Lindsey Schultz, the trainer, Courtney Reed, who of course brought along in many capacities through the game, including with National Steeplechase, and then as the senior director of racing and industry relations for Breeders' Cup, working with Dora Delgado. Actually, a nice mix of Katie Miranda involved as well. Courtney, Breanne Sharp, who does marketing and research coordination for Godolphin. Naja Thompson from the New York Breeders as well. Who else? Jeff Matty, from the Pennsylvania THA. So it's very nice. Dr. Fragula, the racetrack practitioner. So you got vet Eric DaCosta, young Eric DaCosta, who comes out of University of Arizona. I guess there were over 200 when the calls went out for this advisory group, more than 200 responses. So anyway, Lisa will talk about it and how they're going to convene and what they're going to what their processes will be and how often they'll meet, those kinds of things. So good. Thought it was going to be a good week anyway for an update. So she'll join us in about 10 minutes, give or take. And then Phil Schoenthal, Seth Morris. I don't know how this happens in radio or in talk show guest appearance work. But we're going to have in hour two, Seth Morris and Chauncey Morris. There was no planning involved in that. I was going to get Chauncey on to talk about the trainer's dinner, and he couldn't do it yesterday, so pushed him into today. And Seth Morris, I heard from yesterday, he's down at OBS, and of course they're going to start in 3 hours for the sale. He's actually selling a baby, a two-year-old, and so we'll talk to Seth about that. And you know, it's one thing to be a gambler, you know, playing horses. It's a different kind of a gamble when you pinhook. So we'll talk about the differences, and we'll talk to Seth about his post-NHC experience and, you know, what I'm sure has been what he's undoubtedly, you know, thought about, you know, subsequently and replayed in his head. So there's you know, first couple of hours. I've got a couple of other reaches. Andy can't make it today. No Andy Serling today. Maybe tomorrow. Actually, I didn't even ask him. I know he's upstate. The I tell you one thing that I was looking at early this morning. A couple of updates. Yesterday, of course, we had that full experience and you know, touchstone visit with KK about what's going on in at Churchill in terms of who's on hand, which is substantial, like close to 2/3 of the Oaks Derby participants. Dave Grenning updated everybody. It's appearing almost. When I say almost certain, it seems very likely now that deterministic will bypass Derby. I mean, that Christophe Clement went as far as to say, you know, that's the way he's leaning. And you know, Dave's relationship, you know, long relationship with Christophe. So it feels like Grandmo the First for those that are. And there, as I said the other day, there's people that really would like to see him get in the race. Grandmo the First, Victor Barboza, and it feels like they are probably getting in. All right, so I changed, for instance, I changed deterministic's listing to doubtful on my own little tab keep, and so that leaves Endlessly and Sino essentially as decisions. And from every Michael Banahan told Dave that they're going to wait, let Encino go back to the track off the Lexington win, see how he's acting, and you know, watch for appetite and you know, and energy level and that kind of thing before they make any decision. Plus, I suppose that. Suppose that Sheikh Mo might have a say in it. So we'll see about Encino. Otherwise, it'll be the Preakness for him. So either 3 weeks for Derby or a 5 week lead up. And of course, you know, Dave reminding about First Mission, you know, who won the Lex and had designs on. He wasn't getting into the Derby field, but had designs on the Preakness before, you know, he second half of his season or. You know, the middle portion of the season was delayed. So I think you can pretty much pencil in Grandmo the First, Barboza, and Jaramillo is his regular rider. So we'll see on that front. Dave also, and then of course the next two would be Common Defense, McPeak, and if he gets in, he's going to need a rider because Brian Hernandez on Mystic Dan, and then Epic Ride would be next. John Enos and the Biscuit, Adam Biscuitza. But Dave, you know, Dave was addressing the jocks that that could, you know, potentially and are shopping for mounts, and there are a couple of horses that have not officially committed. A couple of outfits, and that includes Danny Gargan and Society Man. I mean, Louis Rivera be exciting, I'm sure, for him. Society Man, uncertain. Catalytic, officially, Safi Joseph and and company have not officially committed to Julien Leperoux. And Anna Marie, you know, Ben Curtis wrote him last, and the Legion team and Whit Beckman, they are mum a little bit. So you do have some mounts. And then, you know, Frankie Dettori, one of the things that Dettori was looking for, you know, staying on and going out to California this winter, was to find himself a Derby mount. So Dettori, Ron Anderson, you know, keeping their hats in the ring. Leperoux was mentioned. Jose Ortiz, you would think would land a mount yet, right? So, yeah, keep tabs. Be sure to be following DRF Grenning, because Dave is churning out the Derby content already. All right. I don't have to manufacture more news for now. I think we can proceed right into conversation. All right. Because, I mean, as generous as Lisa Lazarus is with me, we very frequently end up, you know, going longer than expected, because, you know, there's plenty of interesting topics, and they always have one or two things that's on their agenda that I've got to be prepared for as well. So we'll get started with Lisa Lazarus, and then Phil Schoenthal is going to join us afterward, and we say good morning, Lisa Lazarus. Lise?
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
I can.
Fantastic.
All right. You're a little, you got the speaker going, I think, but it's workable.
I've got AirPods on. If you want me to change to not AirPods, I can do that. I think it'd be better.
Doesn't
sound great? I'll change.
Yeah, it's a little tinny. You got it's regular speaker.
How's that?
Much
is better.
Oh, now see,
okay,
now
great.
See, I'm gonna. Here's some advice. Maybe this is from this is maybe Mandy's arena, but yeah, that gives you a much more, you know, a more authoritative sound.
Fantastic. Well, I am in it. Am I live?
You were, of course you're live. Yeah, of course you're live.
Oh, wow. Okay, great.
Yeah,
fantastic. Well, let's get started.
Exactly. You know, it's funny. I was ready to reach out anyway, and in the wake of Phil Schoenthal and you know, the settling of his case, and then yesterday afternoon after I got off the air, the I think exciting and you know, very positive news and group of next generation, you know, industry stakeholders, participants from virtually every arena selected. And it feels like you had a tremendous response for this.
Yeah, we really did. I have to say, we were incredibly overwhelmed by the interest and the participation. You know, what that really demonstrates to me is that, you know, that next generation of racing participants, you know, recognizes that Haiza is here to stay, and that, you know, they have a stake in trying to make it as effective and as industry supportive as it can be. And, you know, it's great to know that there are so many people in different areas of this amazing industry who are willing to give their time towards that end. You know, constantly being told, you know, you need to get more people involved who know racing, who have spent their lives in racing. And that's, you know, absolutely what we think is beneficial. And so kind of getting that response of people who are actually willing to do the work and have a voice was really heartening.
Let's touch on them. I threw a few names out. I mean, particularly the ones, you know, that I've known and have been friendly with for years, particularly Joe Bianca and Nick Tamaro, but also yeah. Eric DaCosta and Naj Thompson.
Yeah.
Courtney Reed, you know, it's a tremendous eclectic group. I mean, talk about some of the individuals, and I mean, was there a live interview process?
So what we did is we first narrowed it down to 30 applicants, and those 30 applicants were interviewed by the people from my team in Hibu who are essentially running the group. So that's going to be Mackenzie Kirkhead and Sam Reinhart, Alexa Rabbit. And then we have Brandon, who's also, involved. And so Brandon Badgett. So they interviewed them all. And then, going from that 30 to the 60 that were selected was incredibly difficult because the talent was so extreme. Ultimately, where we landed is that we tried to find a geographic diversity, gender diversity, diversity of, small train or big train, sort of different roles in the industry so that we could really cover things from soup to nuts. And so for those that weren't selected from that 30, it was primarily because their voice was covered by somebody else, either in the Horsens Advisory Group or we had too many, as you would imagine, we'd have, multiple, strong applicants from Kentucky, from New York. And so we obviously wanted to take a whole country perspective. And so those are the considerations that ultimately were taken into account to get to that final group.
Well, and we can run them down. Waqas Ahmed, the deputy director of the KHRC.
Yes, Waqas. Yeah, yep. He's fantastic. He's he's been involved for a long time. He's he's sort of Jamie's right hand guy. Jamie is the executive director, and so he's I think he's going to be very impactful.
The two riders, Keith Asmussen and Tyler Gaffney.
Yeah, Tyler. Yeah, veteran and more of a newer but very successful rider in Keith.
You made an effort to also, reach out to regional operations, including Mark Brody, who is the executive director of the new operating authority in Maryland.
Correct. I mean, Maryland is an incredibly important racing state. I think it has a bright future with all the changes that have been made recently. And so, we obviously want somebody who's going to be involved in that process so that we can take, those learnings into, Heise's operations and Heise's decisions.
You got a pair of, top horse players that also serve in other capacities. Both Joe Bianca and Nick Tamaro play the game seriously. And so, for the horse playing community that consistently, frets that the industry doesn't pay the proper attention to, the biggest contributor to the operating of the game, both Nick and Joe really fill that out.
Yeah, no, horse players are such a critical, obviously, component of our industry, and I don't think we utilize them or the intelligence and the kind of insights they can bring nearly enough. And so I'm really happy to have both of those guys on. On top of the fact that, Joe Bianca, I think, runs an interesting business, podcast or racing business with John Green, which I think is really, it's not quite Steve Bick level, but I think it's really, it's a terrific podcast. I listen to it regularly. And then, have somebody from Texas, in Nick Tamaro, who's calling races there, that, that is really also a perspective that's very valued.
Absolute. You've folded in plenty of horsemen, including Devin Doherty, who is an assistant to Christophe Clement. You got Dr. Fragula, racetrack practitioner, Lindsay Schultz, all hands-on horsemen.
Yeah. That's what we're really looking for is, horsemen that are doing this day in and day out and want to have, a very prosperous future for the industry and, obviously for their careers.
Back to the kind of the regional element and also not just regional, but slightly nuanced kinds of experiences. Jeff Maddie from the PTHA, Naj Thompson from from NYFA, yeah, of course.
York. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Courtney Reed, who I've known for years, back to her start with Steeplechase and working for Bill Gallo. And, of course, now, you know, now basically...
Reader's Cup.
Yeah, basically an entry with Dora Delgado. Mm-hmm. And we should mention, Lisa, I mean, obviously, a concerted attempt to make sure that women were well represented in this group.
Correct. Because I think, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, racing has benefited from in recent years is definitely a sort of a diversifying of the leaders within, you know, within racing. And, you know, we've got the women in racing sort of group now that's being led by Stephanie Hironas, I think has been really impactful. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that we had all of those voices in our group. And so I think it's really a good balance.
Well, and of course, with Courtney working in essentially the racing office of the Breeders' Cup, Eric DaCosta, you know, young, recently,
he's awesome.
Yeah, he's everywhere.
He was I think he won the award from the you know, the Racetrack Industry Symposium or the program there in Arizona, and now he's at Oakland. I actually just saw him a couple weeks ago when I was down in Oakland. He's really doing a terrific job there.
And then two names that are fairly new to me, Tyler Peoples and Katie Miranda.
So Katie Miranda works with Jenna Antonucci in Ocala. She's very involved in the sales. She's been in the industry forever. And so we wanted to have somebody who was very close to the sales companies and the sales process and the breeding, you know, essentially part of our business. And also the, you know, obviously the connection to Jenna was also valuable. And then Tyler Peoples is not actually, he works outside the industry, but he came to us with like a 5-page, unbelievably impressive, almost treatise and all the things that he thinks could be, you know, changed, improved, you know, valued in the industry. And we were just so blown away by his deep thinking about the issues that we thought, you know, we should at least have one person who's not directly working every single day in the industry. And we think he brings that perspective.
Interesting. How often will the Next Gen Advisory Group convene? And you say monthly. How do you envision their contributions affecting policy?
Well, first of all, I'm really excited because we have the very first meeting today. So it'll be a chance to really meet everyone, you know, have everyone meet each other and sort of talk about our priorities. We've asked everyone to come to the meeting with at least one kind of idea or concept or priority that they'd like the group to consider, as well as one question about HISA that I or my team can answer, so that they really know kind of what we're doing and what they're working with. I expect that the meeting will run, I expect they'll meet about monthly. And then the plan also is to have some subcommittees who will essentially address, you know, different areas of work or different areas that HISA is obviously working in or trying to improve, so that we can get kind of, you know, one thing I found with the Horsemen's Advisory Group is some of the most effective work we've done has been, we've broken down into subgroups, because it's just an easier way to exchange, et cetera. And so, I think that's the way they're going to run it. It will be run by, you know, Brandon and Mackenzie and Alexa and Sam, who are the next generation, of HIWU HISA folks. And I know they're, you know, incredibly excited to be a part of it.
Very nice. Well, the initiative, was certainly well conceived, and you know, it's great to know that you know, this group will be, you know, will be a conduit, and the, you know, the opportunity for them to, you know, kind of bring you a pulse of the next, you know, next generation. And it's an important message, Lisa. You know, not just for HISA to provide, but for the industry in general, you know, in a time of, you know, I suppose, a time of uncertainty and, you know, and broad-based concerns. It's first of all, nice to know that, you know, 200 plus wanted to make their voices heard. I mean, that's encouraging in and of itself.
For sure. The other thing that I just would love to add before we change topics is that, you know, I think one of the best things, if not the best thing, that HISA has done is to form the Horsemen's Advisory Group. You know, not everyone knows exactly what that group does. You know, there are plans to kind of more formally share the specific areas and rules and items that they've been involved in making a difference on. But by far, that group has been the best resource for HISA as we kind of work through challenges, as we work through rule considerations. You know, they've really been my advisors and have allowed me to see really inside of the way the trainers think, the owners think, the vets think. And it's just been so beneficial. And so really the idea for the next generation came out of the success of working with that group. And then obviously the concept and the idea that we want to make sure that we're taking into consideration and bringing into the fold, you know, those racing leaders of the next generation.
There we go. All right. Well, on that topic, the issues of the day that, you know, that pretty much dominate, you know, your workload, and it seems that a lot of these conversations, Lisa, invariably start with the drugs of human abuse category, which have been vexing for HIWU and for you.
Yeah, so you know we have. You know, as you know, an atypical findings policy that deals with environmental contaminants. And that's been really successful. We've had about 35 or so cases processed under that program. Only, I think, two have been actually taken forward as violations. And they're resolved without ever becoming public. And it's really a system that's worked very well. The issue has been that the human drugs of abuse are not captured in that policy. And the reason they weren't at the outset was that similar to other horse racing and other horse sport organizations, the sort of philosophy is that the environmental contaminants are things that trainers have no way or possibility of minimizing the risk on. You can't do anything about the fact that there might be contaminant in your feed. You can't do anything about the fact that your horse might be producing too much testosterone because it has a tumor or it's a ridgeling or whatever. So those things are very kind of easy to understand why trainers should have zero culpability with regards to those situations. And so they're handled well. What happens, so the piece in the middle that's been, I think, difficult for racing participants to kind of adapt to, and also, you know, frankly, challenging for HISA and HIWU to get it right, is these human drugs of abuse like methamphetamine. Really, meth has been the biggest one, I believe, but also covering cocaine and marijuana. And the reason is that, you know, As a principle, we don't want to have these drugs on the backside. We don't want them to be in horses, right? Like, I don't think anybody would disagree that, you know, methamphetamine shouldn't be in a horse. The difficulty is, you know, are we setting it at the right level so that we're capturing not minute amounts, but actually, you know, genuinely significant amounts of meth in horses. And we've done, you know, I think, as you know, we've already raised that limit to sort of four times what it was under the RMTC. We're going to continue to watch that and look at that. But that is an important thing to always consider. And the second piece is, you know, as you know, we also recently proposed to the FTC that those cases be capped at 60 days maximum instead of the 2 years, because they're viewed as more of a negligence violation than an intentional violation, but that it can be a lot less if there's exculpatory or factors, and if, of course, the trainer can show how it actually got into the horse. So, you know, what happened, I think, with Phil is at a point now where the system is really starting to work effectively, which is he was able to determine, you know, quite quickly what caused the positive. And the reason why it's so important, this whole source question, is that we want to be able to figure out, you know, what's infiltrating the environment. You know, if it's not intentional, we want to be able to know, you know, these are the employees, and so we need to address that. Or this was the, as I said, with the atypicals, this was the feed, or this was the, or this horse has a tumor, so that we can address it, both for the horse and for the industry. And so he was able to determine that. And then he had also, you know, we've been telling horsemen for a while through different educational initiatives that we definitely need to do a better job of because the message isn't getting through, is that, you know, if you have procedures in place in your barn to minimize the risk, like, in other words, you talk to your employees and you tell them, you know, please don't use anything that isn't permitted in the barn. Don't urinate in the barn, all of those sort of, you know, wash your hands if you take a medication. If you do those things, then you're working really hard to prevent the problem from happening, and you should be credited for that. And so that's ultimately what happened with Phil, was that he did, you know, he heard that. I think he explained that he'd read one of the decisions, I think the one involving Jonathan Wong.
Yep.
And he saw what was expected or what would be, I think, more helpful in terms of, you know, acts that the trainer could engage in if, in fact, you came to a point where you had a positive test. And so he did those things. And, you know, I think he was ultimately, I mean, of course, you'd rather it never happen and you'd rather get zero sanction. But I think in the scheme of things, he felt that 15 days was very reasonable, especially because I don't know if you know this, but about a couple of months ago, there was a standard bred trainer who got a year for meth and who also claimed it was contamination. But what I think is really good about our program, and I think this will continue to become more obvious and more helpful to trainers, is that we look at fault. We don't have under the old racing commission system, most racing commissions had a system where if it was in the horse's system, it was ultimate trainer responsibility, and there's nothing you could say to change that. Under our system, we look at fault. We look at all of the facts. And so if your fault is minimal, as Phil's was, you're going to get a minimal sanction. If you, on the other extreme, which I know this is unlikely to happen, but just to demonstrate what I'm trying to explain, is if you have a trainer who knows he's got, like, you know, his whole barn is on meth and they're partying in the barn and urinating the barn, he's just watching and letting it happen, then you're going to have more responsibility. You know, so that's really and I've also said a number of times, and I truly believe this is not solely a trainer's responsibility. We have been really pushing racetracks to be more mindful of, you know, drugs abuse on the backside, to make sure that their receiving barns are cleaned after every single horse. Also, you know, talking to the chaplaincy about ways that we can address, you know, substance abuse on the backside. I mean, we obviously don't want that for our backstretch workers either. So there are multiple touch points, I think, that we need to come at this problem in racing. But as you said, it's been a challenge on the drugs abuse side, but I do think we've worked through those challenges and we'll continue to do so.
A couple of points on this, and I'll let Phil, when he joins us next, I'll let Phil flesh out,
sure,
his reaction and how he approached this.
Yeah.
But it does seem, a couple of things, it does seem, Lisa, that there's this wide variance when we're seeing the arbitrator panels or the arbitrator, you know, individual arbitrators making, you know, decisions, it feels like there's a, you know, there's a cornucopia of potential responses. I mean, and a wide variance in the penalty application. I mean, including the way that Tally Lynch was portrayed by the arbitrator, and in terms of responses to questions, and certainly references in the Jonathan Wong element about the perception that the answers were inconsistent. What are the guidelines, or is it as arbitrary as an arbitrator would make it?
So I think there's a really simple answer that people will understand. If you engage with HILU, which would be like the prosecutor's office, right, and you give them information and you talk to them, they are very likely to offer you a very reasonable settlement, right? But if you choose not to go that way, you just want to fight it, HILU and HISA lose control because then it goes before a judge. Arbitrators are just private judges, right? So it's like if you went to court, you can't predict what that judge is going to do. You hope the judge follows the law and the facts, but that judge is going to consider everything before it and make a decision. And so once you decide to fight the charge, which is absolutely your right, HILU and HISA, or really HILU, because they're the ones in control, lose any ability to impact that outcome other than sharing the facts. And of course, you know, what happened with Natalia Lynch and what happened with Jonathan Wong is the arbitrators found that they were not truthful. You know, they felt right or wrong that they had lied under oath. And so that was really why those outcomes were so harsh, was that they were not believed by the judge. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. Although when you say under oath, I mean, these are not legal proceedings, correct?
No, they are legal proceedings. They're, of course they are.
Okay.
And they are under oath. Yes, and they testify under oath. Yeah, of course.
All right.
I mean, they're not in a court of law, but they're considered legally binding, essentially private judicial proceedings.
Well, exactly. So differentiating, you know, due process versus...
Correct. I mean, they're not going to be charged with perjury the way you would in court, if that's what you mean. But certainly they commit to tell the truth and the whole truth. And if they don't, that's going to certainly be problematic for them.
Yeah, and similarly with the specifics of some of these cases, and Alan brought this up. Alan Forman brought this up last week when we spoke. I mean, if there are levels that, you know, and under RMTC, it was thresholds essentially versus minimum performance levels. If we essentially are agreeing or noting that there isn't necessarily potential to influence performance, why put everybody through this process?
That's actually not our position. We believe it does have a potential, methamphetamine, to influence performance at the level that we're calling positives, is one. And two, the secondary purpose of the program is also to protect horse welfare. So certainly the primary purpose is to have a level playing field and not to allow performance enhancement. But we also, as part of the program, don't want anything in a horse's system that shouldn't be there that has the potential to adversely affect the horse's health. And, you know, I think everybody could agree that we don't want methamphetamine in our horses at a level that is potentially impactful, that they potentially feel. You know, obviously, administration studies on meth are sparse because it's hard to, you know, get agreement to do a trial or an administration study, you know, but when you actually intentionally give methamphetamine to horses. But, you know, the design of the program is for the labs to agree on a level that they think is the appropriate level on which to call a positive. That has to continually be reviewed by science, for sure. And as we get more information and we do more studies, you know, the laboratories will consistently reconsider those levels. But I don't accept that we're testing at levels that have no performance enhancing impact, because that's not, you know, that is not the philosophy behind the program.
All right. I'll use that as a segue then to a couple of other topics at large, including a follow up to the incident involving the Kentucky lab, and in general, Lisa, the lab harmonizations, and talk a little bit about where things stand on that front.
So sure. So first of all, one of the essential components to a successful program, and one of the things that I think gives us a real advantage under Heisen Haiwu versus the old state raising commission system, is that the laboratories aren't siloed. You know, they're working together to agree on harmonized screening limits, which is essentially where they all agree at, okay, we think at a 5, that's the right place to call it a positive. You know, there are very few substances where we go to limits of detection. Those are things like, you know, EPO or things that are clearly never supposed to be in a horse and are very performance enhancing, and you can't always, you know, control be certain of the timing, et cetera. But the laboratories will discuss substances and they will work together and they will agree on a level in which to call a positive. I think the recent information we had was that we have about 350 analytes that are harmonized. So, and those are the 350 most common substances that you know are actually identified by laboratories. As new substances come into play, as new things, you know, are introduced into horses, probably for performance enhancing purposes, you know, the laboratories will add those substances to the list as they come to be. So that's really important, because we don't, you know, if we have one set of rules in Kentucky and one set of laboratory directives, and then that's different from New York or different from California, that's incredibly unfair to horsemen, because you have no way of knowing whether the program, especially on therapeutics that you're using, I mean, obviously banned substances are different, but the program that you're using, you have no idea if you're withdrawing at the right point in time for every state, right? So that's something we've really tried to clean up. It's an ongoing process. It doesn't happen overnight, but we're way further along now than we were, you know, about a year ago when we started. In terms of the Kentucky lab, you know, obviously I can't share, the investigation is still ongoing, and so I can't share specific details. But what I can say is that Kentucky was underperforming from a turnaround time standpoint. They were not complying with the contractual requirements that vets list be returned within 5 days and post-race 14. They were consistently missing those benchmarks, which is incredibly unfair to horsemen, because horsemen rely on, especially vets lists, coming back in a timely manner so they can enter horses in races. And when you have to scratch a horse or not enter your horse in a race because the vets list test didn't come back, that is like completely unacceptable to us. And you can imagine how furious horsemen are when that happens. That was one of the issues we had to cover. There were some other issues that are currently being investigated. They've lost their accreditation. Or the accreditation has been suspended, I should say, as you may be aware. And the last thing I'll say about that is, you know, HISA and HIWU, especially HIWU, they really dig into the lab's operations, the labs that are, you know, in our program. And we hold those labs to a very high standard. And I'm not so sure or confident that without that involvement of HIWU and the harmonization of labs and really working hard in the laboratory program, that some of the concerns that we've identified with Kentucky would ever have come to light. And, you know, I am 100% confident that the industry is far better off now that we've identified some concerns at the Kentucky lab and that investigation is happening. And if we could just let it, you know, go on forever. And so this is some of, I think, the benefits of professionalization and really more bringing everything under one umbrella, is you get to really see under the hood and nobody can hide. And we're able to expose those weaknesses and those areas where they're just not meeting our standards.
How close are you to adding another lab, or will you operate the way you have in terms of farming out that work,
So right now, the laboratories that are under our program are handling easily the volume that we have. And so, you know, my perspective is that in a lot of ways, the fewer labs you have, the better, because you have less scope for variances, right?
Yeah.
And so as long as they're handling the samples that we have in efficient, quick, professional way, then I don't think there's any reason to add labs. That being said, once the Kentucky investigation is complete, if Kentucky, is able to address the concerns that we have, we would certainly, you know, that lab is very well equipped. The university is fantastic. The people who lead the university are very invested in our industry and very, you know, focused and contribute a lot. So we would certainly consider bringing the Kentucky samples back to that lab once their issues have been rectified.
Very good. All right. And similarly, along evaluation or essentially, even before I actually ask about Lasix, what kind of investment is being made to chase down, what is referred to as undetectables?
So a significant investment, and that's also, I think, coming back to the whole laboratory, the value of having laboratories working together. Because instead of, again, working in silos and on very limited budgets to try to develop new testing and get ahead of what might potentially be out there, and we can often look to human sports as a, you know, as a kind of preview of what's to come and what might hit the equine industry. And they're able to say, okay, you know, lab one, I'm going to focus more on, you know, next generation EPO. Lab two, I'm going to focus more on blood builders, you know, so they can kind of divide up the work and work together. And I think that just gives us a much better chance of developing those tests more quickly and more effectively. And I've already seen like sort of big changes, and I think progress over the last, I guess it's 10, 11 months since the program has been in place. But it allows us to, you know, people complain a lot about cost, you know, of HISA, and we're trying to address that in a number of ways, you know, including through looking to governments and public funding and grant funding to try to defray some of the costs. But the good thing, I believe, about our program is that we're using that money really effectively and efficiently. When you've got like 25 states that are working on all different kinds of things and there's no coordination, you don't have as good a chance as getting a good outcome. And so the money that we're spending on all of this is being used effectively, it's targeted, it's efficiently, and all the labs are in the loop and are working together. And I think that gives us, as I said, a much better chance of being successful.
Well, because that I don't think it's a surprise if I say that, you know, it's a breakthrough, undetectable kind of a progress or positive, if and when one's called, that, you know, that the public, the, you know, the fan base and the horse player base and you know, those, you know, hoping for that desired level playing field, that let's be frank, where the meths and, you know, the metformins, you know, the run of the mill therapeutic, overages, that's not what anybody, you know, was worried about or thinking about with the desire to have, you know, this kind of a authority, you know, essentially, you know, bringing the uniformity goes a long way, Lisa, and that's a positive in itself. But, you know, for a lot of the, you know, the populace involved, getting real cheaters, quote unquote, found out and you know, eradicated is the goal. And I don't think it's unfair for me to say that no one really senses that has happened per se. You know, there's been, you know, when you talk about Phil Schoenthal's and Mike Lowers and Rusty Arnold's, these are not and George Weaver's, these are not the people that we're worried about.
Yeah, so a couple of things I'm gonna say about that. One is, I do, you know, it's like saying, you know, one person's like terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. Like it's I get a lot of calls from people who do think that we have, you know, sanctioned some of the bigger cheaters. I have no view on that. I don't know, you know, I don't know trainers. I'm not on the backside every day. But I guess I would say is that there's a divided view on whether or not that's true. Now, when people say that we caught enough cheaters, of course not. No, we haven't. We've just potentially made a dent. But there are a lot of people who would say that we've caught some. The people that you named are obviously the outliers and represent substances that are not, you know, that are not as big a concern to us as some of the others that we've been able to sanction or to at least identify. This is, you know, as I said, we're 11 months in. This is part of the process. A big part of what's going to allow us to achieve more success in that area is successful investigations, intelligence, using sources, and all of those things are in play, but they take a little bit of time to develop those investigations. They don't happen overnight. If you do them right, you need to, you know, make sure you have the right evidence, et cetera. So this is obviously an ongoing initiative. We're going to get, you know, better and better all the time. But there's two other things I want to add to that. Is one is, I do think that, at least anecdotally, I hear from a lot of people that there is a prophylactic effect, that people are, you know, the people that you know, I guess people who are always going to cheat might still be cheating or taking an edge. I don't know. But there's a lot of people who potentially were doing so or maybe cheating, you know, taking a bit of an edge because they felt like the person beside them was doing it and they had to do it to compete. And that the risks now of kind of facing an edge doping violation are so significant that the incentive to do that has really been diminished. I hope that's true. I don't know if that's true. We're going to look at all of that data once we have a full year of data to look at. But certainly I would hope that there is some impact in that regard. And the second thing is, you know, the industry has a scorecard, I've learned, of who they think are the good guys and they think are the bad guys. And I don't disagree with that scorecard, but it's just not a way that a governing body can operate. We can only operate based on positive tests that come back from the lab and barn searches and the evidence. And so we've got to treat everybody the same. And, you know, one of the things I thought was really interesting about what Phil said is, if you read like his comments and I think the TDN and the Pollock report, he said, you know, it used to be you can go into the steward's office and talk to them and say, you know, listen, I didn't mean this to happen. They knew who you are, they knew your petition. They'd say, okay, we believe you. It's true. That's not our system anymore. You know, we have a more professionalized, more unified system that is based solely on positive tests and as I said, you know, barn searches or possession cases. And so that is a hard thing to adjust to because nobody wants, you know, the Rusty Arnolds of the world to have to face a sanction. You know, I know Rusty Arnold personally. I think he's been, you know, I know he has a reputation of being an upstanding horseman. But, you know, his horse has a positive for a substance that is a really serious substance in horse sport, in cycling. It's the only positive test we've gotten since the program was started with that particular substance. I personally don't believe that Rusty did anything intentionally, but what could we do differently as the governing body? You know, we've got to process it the way that the rules are laid out. And ultimately, you know, he got a 7-day sanction where under the KHRC, that would have been 6 months. You know, we have it as a Class B, which is categorized significantly lower than it used to be. And also that it's categorized in horse sport. In horse sport, it's a 2-year violation. And for a Class B, which is 14 or 15 days, I think it's 15 days. If you accept your sanction, you can go down to 7. And so, you know, he served 7 days. I'm not happy he did, you know, based on what I know of him, but my feelings about him and anybody else's, they're just, we can no longer integrate that in how we process cases under the program. Now, certainly, if he had decided to contest, I'm just using Rusty as an example because I think he's widely viewed to be, you know, an upstanding trainer. If he had wanted to fight the case and he went before an arbitrator, you know, his clean record, his past, all of that would have been considered. But it would have been an arbitrator's decision. You know, but by taking the 7 days, you know, it was really, he was able to sort of do it at a time that was convenient for him before Keelan and Churchill opened. And he made the decision not to fight it and to do that instead, which I think is also an option that we offered that was not available under the Racing Commission, that you could essentially have your sanction if you decide not to fight it. So, but these are all things that we're going to have to continue to look at, work out. But I'm very confident we're going to get to a place where everybody feels comfortable with the way that the system is working.
Well, a couple of things before I ask about the LASIK study.
Sure.
It's a misidentification to basically suggest that under RCI policies that people weren't, you know, were treated unequally. Because there's been, you know, trainer responsibility rules, and they may have varied, you know, from state to state, but, you know, they were there. Part of the benefit of, the old system, quote unquote, that it was private. And in a lot of cases, when there was a situation that really didn't need to be made public, it wasn't. Here it's, you know, potentially the alleged offending party, you know, under a spotlight, and then maybe back up and get the specifics. And that's what seems, I mean, that's what is sort of a kilter here, Lisa. That's the one part of this that you know, that yes, the various process has, you know, has cleared Mac Robertson and you know, basically cleared Phil and Kerry Bryan and Rusty Arnold, but it's done so in a humiliating and reputation injuring fashion.
I mean, listen, there's a few things I'll say to that. One is we don't actually make cases public for therapeutic overages or for drugs and abuse now until you get past the B sample and the case is going to prosecution. You know, when we were creating the rules, the industry asked for more transparency. Everybody asked for more transparency. This is the way that the system works in horse sports, the way it works in human sport. And so that was the system that we delivered. Do we need to look at modifications to that? Yeah, maybe. I think that's something we can obviously continue to look at and tweak if we think that there are certain categories where we should treat that differently. I mean, it's the reason why we don't make anything public on the environmental contamination cases. Those never become public because it's more likely than not that they're going to be dismissed. But, you know, you got to balance transparency with protecting the rights of the trainers and the responsible people and people that are charged. And so that's where we came out on that balance. I think there are a lot of people who would say that they think it's, you know, it's a good outcome. And I guess in my experience and from all the phone calls that I get and the conversations I have, I believe that when, you know, a trainer is exonerated publicly or gets a minimal sanction with an explanation as to why that's positive, that the racing public actually really embraces those people. And sometimes, in some cases, actually martyrs them to some extent, you know? I don't think Rusty Arnold, personally, from what I've experienced, and this is a personal subjective opinion, but I'm the target, as you can imagine, of a whole lot of phone calls about these things. I don't think that he ultimately suffered reputational damage. I actually really don't. If anything, I think he got a whole lot of people, you know, supporting him because he's earned that, you know, over a 40-year career, whatever it is, he's earned that trust. He's earned that reputation. But I don't disagree with you that we have to be very careful about where we draw the line there, and that it's something that we need to really evaluate over and over again.
Speaking of evaluations, bring everybody up to speed on the LASIX committee's work.
Sure.
and where we stand with that study.
Sure. So under the Act, LASIX is the one area that actually the law itself gives us very clear instructions. We don't make rules around LASIX. The Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act actually establishes what we need to do. So as you know, right now, LASIX is prohibited under HISA. However, any state can ask for an exemption for races that are not stakes races or two-year-olds. And every state has asked for that exemption. So basically, LASIX are used, you know, across the country and HISA jurisdictions for anything outside of stakes and two-year-olds. The Act requires us to convene a study within 3 years, or have the results of a study, I should say, within 3 years of the launching of the anti-doping program. That was launched, as you know, on May 22nd, 2023. So we have until May 22nd, 2026. We put together an incredibly impressive furosemide committee that's led by Dr. Jennifer Durenberg, who's HISA's Director of Equine Safety and Welfare. And they put out requests for proposals to answer all of the questions that the Act poses about LASIX. And those proposals were met with a number of different research initiatives. The committee selected which of those to recommend to the board. The board approved those, and 3 grants have been handed out to essentially answer those questions. And we expect to get that, you know, research back, I believe, within a year or 18 months. And then once that happens, the committee will continue to, you know, will evaluate the outcomes and sort of put together essentially a whole summary of what was discovered, all of the research, and provide that to the board, who will then make a decision about whether or not to ban LASIX going forward. And if you know, they can do anything between banning it, allowing it entirely, or keeping the system we have now.
Well, with Passover about 10 days away, how is this study different from all other studies?
as somebody who celebrates Passover, I love that analogy. So the way that it's different is that it started with essentially pulling together all the prior studies in order to figure out kind of what was missing and what gaps needed to be filled. And we have really put together, I believe, the most objective committee that has only one goal, which is to determine whether or not LASIX has a performance-enhancing effect, whether it has a welfare effect, all the issues that essentially we all really want to know, but from legitimate studies and unbiased studies. And I am, you know, very confident that that's what this group and these researchers are going to do. We don't have no predetermined outcome. And, you know, I feel good about essentially the scholarship and the research that's being focused on these really important questions.
So many important questions, and more than four. And Lisa, as always, thanks so much.
Well,
I've got it's not my first day, nor yours. This was terrific, as always, and we'll keep regular communiques and updates and whatever you need. You know, brought out there to stakeholders. Don't hesitate.
Appreciate that. And anytime I can be helpful to you, please let me know. As you know, I don't mind the difficult questions. They all need to be answered. So thank you for giving me the chance.
Not at all. Lisa Lazarus, everybody, and Heisa, and, these are going to be continuing ongoing, discussions, and they've evolved themselves as the authority, and, you can tell that they want to do the right thing. They want to have the right mechanisms in place, and to be commended on that front. Let's swing right around and bring in Phil Schoenthal, because Phil, just went through this whole process had to endure some uncertainty and undoubtedly, anxious moments. Maybe I'm being overly sensitive for guys like Phil and Rusty and Mike Lauer and Kerry Bryan. Phil, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
First of all, obviously happy that there's a satisfactory resolution to this, because I know how unsettling and upsetting the whole thing was to you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There was obviously some tenuous times in the process, but it's very, very thrilled to have it resolved.
Hey, talk about and flesh out a few of the elements that you cited. In fact, I saw the piece by Sue Finley, and I thought that you came away after some uncertainty. You came away very satisfied with the mechanics of the process and the fairness of the resolution.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, anytime you are served notice of banned substance positives, your heart wants to fall through the floor, and every terrible scenario runs through your mind of your career passing before your eyes into the oblivion, and so once you kind of get over the initial shock of the situation that you're in, you start to think rationally and try to work your way through the process. And I'm foolhardy, and some people were upset with me that I didn't run off and hire a lawyer immediately and go that route. But I just felt like I had a very good case and believed that common sense would prevail, and that I had a good story to tell, and in the end, I found that Heisa and Haiwu were very reasonable with me and dealt with me very fairly, and I was pleased to get the outcome that I was hoping for.
In terms of your response, and obviously it it's, I don't want to say, well, I guess embarrassing to some degree for, obviously, for the personnel involved, you know, to be, you know, to ask them to, you know, to be tested, you know, and it provides a different, you know, a different set of challenges for you as a, you know, as a manager, as a, you know, as a office manager, as it were.
Right.
I mean, talk about that, and because I don't recall, Phil, that anybody else necessarily immediately thought to test, you know, their help.
Well, I think there have been some cases where they found that help had tested positive after the fact, which is, you know, obviously the obvious place to look. I was very fortunate for my scenario that the ruling against Jonathan Wong, when I had read that, when it came out, it really opened my eyes to, I guess, the process that we currently live in. You know, in the old days, prior to HISA and HIWU, you know, if you got a positive, you walked into the steward's office and you met with probably a retired trainer and a retired jockey and guys in your local jurisdiction that you probably know very well personally. And you can sit down and have a conversation about what you think happened, and they understood that and believed you, and whatever punishment was meted out, you know, is kind of the way this game has always operated. But under the new jurisdiction of HISA and HIWU, you know, they have a set of rules, and it's their job to enforce them. And for the most part, you know, they are professional people that come from the professional world and don't really maybe understand the ways of the racetrack and the way things have always been done and what we expect. And it's kind of incumbent on us as trainers to realize that we are in a new world where we are expected to be professionals in the regard that we should have, you know, HR policies and drug policies and you know, professional training of our staff and documented all those things. You know, and I'm fortunate to have had some experience in the real world to know what some of those things look like. And so when I read the Jonathan Wong ruling, and I don't know Jonathan personally, I've never spoken with him and don't really know a lot about his case besides what I read, you know, but he presented all these various defenses for himself that when I read them, I realized would have been the exact same defenses that I was going to present if I was in that situation where, you know, you tell them, well, I told my employees not to pee in stalls, and I hired a polygraph test to verify my innocence. But all those things were thrown out for the various reasons they were thrown out for, because, you know, he couldn't tangibly prove, you know, that he was actually doing those things or whatever, you know. And so I sat down at that point and, you know, typed out some basic trainings and manuals for my employees, and we got them all together, and we talked about the dangers of contamination and positives and drug use in the workplace and all the various factors that trainers have to deal with these days, and had every one of my employees, you know, sign a paper saying that they understood what they were being taught and that they agreed with those things. And, you know, I installed surveillance cameras in the barn to kind of monitor activities and put up signs in the barn, you know, about not peeing in stalls and all this sort of stuff. And in the end, when I was able to show the investigators all that stuff, I think that's really what set me apart from a lot of other cases. And I think that somebody I spoke with at HIWU had indicated to me that I was the first case that had come before him that had actually, you know, taken tangible, provable, verified steps to try to mitigate these risks instead of just saying, well, the horse must have been contaminated in the receiving stall, you know. And I think what's lucky for me, and I hate to use the word lucky because you're talking about people's lives, but in these banned substance cases, if you're going to have any traction at all to get a reduced sentence, you know, you really have to be able to prove where the source of the positive drug came from and how it got there, rather than just kind of throwing your hands up in the air and saying, I don't know how it happened, it's just contamination. You know, that's not a good enough excuse or reason And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on who you are, you know, I had some employees, and one of them was the groom of both horses, test positive for methamphetamines within the subsequent drug tests. And we had a very clear and convincing story to tell as to how it happened. And also then, as I explained, what I had done to try to mitigate those risks. And I think all those things combined, you know, were enough to get me to a very fair and reasonable outcome.
Yeah, and you know, for those that, you know, if you're not in the Mid-Atlantic, you might not, you know, not know Phil's name as readily. And, you know, Phil's got a reputation, for those that aren't aware, of being as conscientious and about as concerned for particularly what goes into the horse. I mean, I think back to, it's been a few years, the conversation we had about, you know, you growing, you know, your own, some of your own feed, right, for yeah. horses. I mean, you're not somebody that, you know, it runs a slapdash operation. And, you know, that's part of the conversation I just had with Lisa, you know, is, you know, the consciousness for people, at least that are close to the game, that you know, have an understanding of and have watched, observed, you know, how certain outfits are run. I mean, that you know, your name comes up in this thing, and you everybody knew immediately. Rusty is the same way. I mean, you're talking about people that would be, that are aghast at even the suggestion of impropriety of this kind. So it
yeah, you know, and in fairness, you know, I think that if I could do anything in regards to my case differently, in hindsight, somebody early on in the process, and I don't remember who, had kind of indicated to me that Haiwu really didn't want to speak with you at all, that everything had to be communicated by email because they want the documented, you know, communications going back and forth. And so I never actually spoke with anybody at Haiwu until I was surprised that I was provisionally suspended. I was operating under some bad information that was not going to happen. And so, you know, I was kind of caught off guard at the last minute when it all kind of went down earlier in the week, and I got a little frustrated with it and picked up the phone and reached out directly to the lawyers at Haiwu. And it might not be a popular thing to say, but I had nothing but a positive experience dealing with Haiwu directly and HISA directly. I wish I had picked up the phone a month earlier, and I think I might have avoided a lot of the heartache that I experienced this week. But they were very receptive to me, were willing to listen, were helpful. And I feel like I, you know, got a positive result more so because of the direct communication and their willingness to listen to me and help me in the end more than anything else. And I wish I had just called them sooner. I might have gotten it resolved a whole lot sooner.
Is there from that, and that's one of the reasons, you know, we're urging people to, you know, to read. Well, this is the Sue Finley piece was the first one I read, and you know, you're quoted obviously extensively. You know, what other advice do you have for horsemen that you know, that get caught up in this?
Well, I mean, I think it's first and foremost, every horseman by now, if you haven't realized, you need to realize that, you know, nobody is immune to something like this happening. That this can happen to anybody, anytime, anywhere. With the picogram levels that they test to now, you know, it's just a matter of, I've told my owners from the onset, you know, it's kind of a matter of when and not if, and I feel that way for everybody. And so it's incumbent upon us to realize the environment that we are operating our businesses in, and realize that, you know, at this point in time, because of where we're at in the horse racing industry, that it's incumbent upon us to handle our business in a more professional way than perhaps what we're used to. And that means doing all these things that I described, and probably more. you know, and I had told Lisa Lazarus when I spoke with her, I said, you know, look, I am happy to, you know, do what I can to try to educate everybody out there that, you know, these are the things that we are expected to do now. And I think it's kind of a surprise for a lot of horse trainers, you know, and not very well understood. And I think that we can probably do a much bigger job of, especially using my case as a template and an example of what Heisa and Haiwu is expecting to see from professional horse trainers and how we can go about satisfying the requirements for exonerating ourselves.
Well, and I mean, much as you frame that, Rusty Arnold had a lot of the same messaging as well. You know, in his experience, he I don't think he would characterize it. He didn't characterize it as pleasant as an experience in the end as that you have, but the messaging is the same, and I mean the reality is, as Lisa just alluded to, I mean it the process is continuing to, you know, take shape. Right. You know, and the way in which each case is being handled seems to be improving along the way. I mean, based on this experience, you know, George Weaver is going to, you know, go through this with the metformin scenario as well. So,
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's I've always kind of operated, you know, in this basic tenet in life that I do my very best not to give anybody a hard time who's just doing their job. And I kind of started that years ago, you know, when you're driving back and forth across the stable gate to watch horses breeze 10 times on a Saturday morning. And every time you drive through the gate, the guy wants to see your badge again, even though you just drove by 10 minutes ago, you know, and it's easy to get frustrated and say, you know, really, I just showed it to you 10 minutes ago. But here's a guy who's just doing his job, who's trying to feed his family, and his boss tells me he's got to check everybody. And it's not for me to give him a hard time about that. He's just doing his job. And I think that served me well in dealing with Haiwu is that, you know, Haiwu did not write these rules. They did not, you know, create these rules. They're just attorneys that are tasked with enforcing these rules that are black and white and the letter of the law and federal law. And so, you know, it doesn't serve a lot of positive momentum to, you know, treat them as the bad guy, I would say. I mean, I felt like I handled myself very professionally in dealing with them, and I think that went a long way in helping to resolve the case.
Well, as we said at the outset, very pleased that, there was a resolution, because I know when we exchanged some notes last week, you were getting, you know, you were antsy about, you know, where this was headed and you know, the elements that were still up in the air. So this is, you can tell, a satisfying conclusion.
Yeah, no, for sure. I was pleased with it. It certainly was a huge weight off my shoulders. And like I said, I'm, you know, I've been in contact with numerous horsemen last night and this morning of people who are reaching out and trying to figure out how they can change their practices and operation to kind of more mirror what I had done to help protect themselves. And that's what everybody needs to do. And you know, I think it's incumbent upon us, our trade organizations, you know, the horsemen's groups to try to get it out there to everybody to say, hey, look, this is what is expected going forward. You know, and, you know, we all have a choice to do our best and try to line up and cooperate and get along or not, you know.
Well, on a happier note, a much more exciting discussion point. You're coming off essentially a tie for your best year professionally last year, and off to off to a very good start in 2024. Certainly noticed, you know, what to. 2-3 weeks ago when Determined Driver won the Beyond the Wire stakes, and I had thought to reach out to you. So here's the chance to talk about it. And then I see Determined Princess came back a week or 10 days ago and broke her maiden.
Yeah, no, we had an excellent start to the season. My year is typically very cyclical in that I seem to train a lot of grass horses, and obviously start with two-year-olds every year, and the grass horses and two-year-olds don't really get cranked up and running till, you know, early summer and fall is kind of when we really pick up momentum, and we're usually very, very quiet over the winter and spring. And this year, for whatever reason, you know, we had some horses in the barn that were in great form early in the season, and we've gotten off to a bang and a much better start than we normally have in a racing season. So that's been exciting. You know, I've got a pretty small stable. You know, it's kind of a boutique, hands-on operation, and you know, I only train 22, 23 horses at a time. And, you know, I would say that legitimately, you know, prior to all this high woofing kind of hit me in the face, but, you know, I've got 6 or 7 legitimate stake horses in the barn right now. Yeah. of that small group, and I feel like I was poised for possibly a breakout year with a couple of graded stake horses, and you know, unfortunately it's probably going to be a little bit derailed at this point in time for now, but you know, it's rewarding when you feel like, you know, the job that you're doing is actually, you know, paying off, so to speak. And you know, and I think that that's the scary thing for all horsemen right now is, you know, when I was kind of having some dark days in this process, you know, you kind of start feeling sorry for yourself a little bit, and that, you know, I've spent my entire life honing my craft and trying to get better at what I do, and to think that it all can be, you know, gone in the blink of an eye is a scary thing. But luckily for me, and I know, you know, it wasn't all that long ago that, you know, I was living in a hospital watching my son slowly die from a failing heart, waiting for a heart transplant. And ever since then, you know, I've had a very keen, line in my mind of what is actually a problem and what is just noise, you know, and ever since then, you know, I've had a much more laid back attitude about life and dealing with the noise and being able to know what is actually a problem and what is just noise. And this situation was starting to maybe bump up against that line a little bit, but in the end, you know, my family is happy and healthy. You know, I'm happy and healthy. We all have good health and doing good right now. And, you know, whatever happens, happens, and it's just noise, you know. So I think being able to keep perspective on life and what's going on around you is the key to happiness, really.
Well, in addition to the checking on the horses in the barn, we certainly were gonna check up to about Emerson, and everything continues to be good.
He's fantastic. You know, he is just doing wonderfully. We've never really had any major hiccups, you know, outside of that first year that he got his heart transplant. He's playing ice hockey and goes to school, and he's playing flag football right now on a local team, and just loves life. And he's never met a stranger. You know, we call him the mayor because one day he'll be the mayor. He just glad hands everybody and loves life. And he's really, honestly, he's maybe the happiest kid I've ever known. I mean, he's just happy. And it's just so, so great every day to see him come up from school and just run up and say, you know, what are we doing today, Dad? Are we going to play football? Are we going to feed the fish? Are we going to go fishing? You know, and we really enjoy him a lot.
And I mean, his Donate Life is active, right?
Yeah, no, she ran second a couple times over the winter on the dirt to Charlestown, and we went ahead and put her away for a little break, knowing that she was Virginia bred and probably preferred the grass. And so we gave her a little break and resting her up for the grass season here. And we're looking forward to hopefully a big summer at Colonial with her.
Excellent. And wow, she's Virginia bred, right? Hank, that's Hank Nothap.
Yeah, no, Hank, when I bought her, you know, I only paid a ham sandwich for, I think he gave $8,000 for it, the horse sale kind of on a whim. Because she was Virginia bred and she had a nice pedigree, and Hank called me up immediately and said, "Hey, you know, I'll partner with you on that horse." And I said, "Great." And Hank is he is an Aces kind of owner. He cares about aftercare. He cares about every horse he ever bred that they find a good landing spots. And he's been a wonderful client to have, and I'm thrilled for him that he's got some really nice horses right now.
Well, should ask a couple others while I got you. Prodigy Doll.
So unfortunately, Prodigy Doll was one of the ones that got caught up in the meth positive.
Right.
And because the initial uncertainty of how it was going to go, and you know, the initial thoughts about what that might mean for her career, if she was going to be on 60 days suspension and have to be on a vets list and all this sort of stuff, the decision was made to go ahead and retire her and get her bred. So she was bred to American Pharoah, and I think they're counting days till they find out if she's pregnant. So we're excited about that. And obviously it's disappointing to lose a great estate caliber filly out of the barn. But when they're going to be retired to get bred to American Pharoah, it's exciting. So we're thrilled for her and happy for Hank.
Very nice. She, of course, great estate placed at least, right?
Correct. Yeah, she was third in the Fritchie in her last start.
Yeah, exactly. And I saw that just last week, actually, opening weekend at Keeneland, you tried Living Magic. You tried her coming out of the Cincinnati Trophy. You gave her a shot in the Appalachian.
Yeah, you know, we've always felt like she's probably, grass is probably her best surface. You know, we brought her off the layoff and ran her in the Cincinnati Trophy just to kind of put a race in her and see where we were at. I don't think that she really handled the surface that day. It was kind of a quirky racetrack day at Turfway. I think speed was really good that day, and she just kind of was very, you know, one pace and didn't kick on. So we brought her back to Fair Hill, and she really came out of that race fantastic and was breezing fantastic, and thought a shot, you know, in the graded race at Keeneland on the grass was appropriate. We really felt like, you know, we were taking down a horse that had a real shot in the race, and we're really excited. And unfortunately, I don't know if you watched her in the race specifically, but she just kind of had a nightmarish trip, and it was not the rider's fault whatsoever, just the way it worked out from the two hole, that she just couldn't ever find a seam and then got blocked turning through home and lost all chance. And so we didn't, you know, don't think anything less of her. We feel like she belongs with those horses, and we're looking back to get her back in some graded stake action at some point here in the summertime for sure.
Well, there's also a horse that's only made one start, but I do want to ask about Determined Candy, who is cut out to be a nice horse.
Yeah, no, we were very excited about her. You know, she was breezing very, very well. She had a little bit of terrible luck. When she was entered for her first start at Laurel in the very first part of March, and was shipped down to race, I think probably had gotten treated by Lasix at that time. When I got notified by email about the second positive for the meth of Determined Driver, and I was notified on the Tuesday of the first one and then Friday for the second one, and she was entered to run that Friday, and we quickly realized that obviously we had a much bigger or different problem than what we first imagined. I mean, when you have one that's positive, of course, you immediately assume it's contamination in a receiving barn or a pony person or a starting gate person, or, you know, there's a million possibilities as to how or why it happened. And we were starting to work through that process. But when a second horse tests positive, that happens to be groomed by the same groom, you know, it kind of narrows down your search quite a bit. And unfortunately, Determined Candy had the same groom. So she was entered that afternoon, and I talked with the owner, and I said, look, you know, here's the situation. I don't know if we can, you know, take this kind of risk, and I don't know what to say other than, you know, we agreed that prudence was the better part of valor.
Yep.
I called the stewards and said, look, you know, I said, I've got a problem, and I'm not sure what it is, but that this horse is groomed by the same groom that had the other two. I said, we don't feel comfortable running her and would prefer to scratch. And it was probably within 2 or 3 hours of the race. And the steward said, hey, you know, no problem. We understand. We'll go ahead and take her out. You know, best of luck to you. So we scratched her. You know, the time goes by and you know, the withdrawal time on a contamination of meth is probably less than 24 hours. And, you know, several weeks went by, and we were trying to find a race for, and we wanted to get her started because we're thinking that she's maybe a state caliber filly and want to get the season going. A race came up at Penn National, and even though the purse is not the level of purse that we were maybe looking for, we decided to put her in just to get her going. Got up there to Penn National, treated with Lasix. They run the first race and canceled for high winds. So we put her on the van back down the lower Fair Hill here and started looking for plan C and D. I entered her in New York. The race wouldn't go. I entered her against the fillies at Laurel. The race didn't go. And then they had the race against the boys that they had up for entries. And I said, you know, I like this filly. Let's just go ahead and put her in. And we did. And you know, I think she ran well. She broke well, was sitting near the pace. I think it was a pretty hot maiden race for Laurel, to be honest with you. There were some pretty well-regarded horses in there. You know, she didn't like the kickback in her face around the turn and kind of dropped off the bit and kind of backed up a little bit. And then when she got in the clear, she came running again and was a real good second. So we're excited about her and think that she's a pretty nice filly.
Well, she's out of a terrific Samson family, and her dam ended up in the hands of John Sakura. But Eye of the Sphinx, the dam of Eye of the Leopard, Sphinx herself, she won the Woodbine Oaks, and of course, Eye of the Leopard, a Queen's Plate winner. This is a nice family that, in fact, Hotel.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's relatively unclear to us at this point in time. You know, here at Fair Hill, obviously we have the ability to breeze both on the tapita and the dirt, as well as we have grass fields. And, you know, we're not certain yet which is her best surface. I mean, it would not surprise me based on her family if she ends up being more of a turf horse. But she had breezed so well in the dirt, you know, we obviously decided to get her started off there. But she's a nice family. I had a nice conversation with John Sakura. We had bought her from his consignment. He had bred her. And he was very excited about her first start and was really excited about her future. So it's fun to have a nice horse in the barn.
And plenty of them. Phil, everybody pleased that this is resolved. And just another few days to wait to put in some entries. Turf is coming and spring is here. So well done. And you handled it, you know, just like a professional, and that was to be expected.
I appreciate your time, Steve.
Phil Schoenthal, and so many positives out of this conversation, including his son Emerson, which was you'd think this was harrowing. How about having a toddler needing a heart transplant? Unbelievable. Good to catch up with Phil. We're going to take our only break of the morning, and I mean, we're a little behind, but it'll be fine. Second half today, Seth Morris and Chauncey Morris. they might be sort of Irish twins, but as far as I know, they're not related. Seth Morris is down at Ocala, and I'm way behind getting to him. Dave Hill is going to join us. I was hinting that we might have a fun visit. It's actually bittersweet. We're going to talk about the book that comes out today, Walk On. Stephen Panis, the story of his son Jake. And I think a lot of you are familiar with it. Dave involved in this, and initially was reaching out to Dave because he wrote a terrific he wrote a terrific piece that I tweeted out early this morning. I had noticed it yesterday, and I read it early this morning. And it was just great. About his work as a writer, but also his origins as a union organizer. And the transition, you know, that he made. And it's about freelance work and cobbling together, essentially a career, and There's a lot of parallels in the piece to racing. There's a lot of parallels, as with everything that Dave writes. There's a universal message. It is a rare, unique talent in that way. That whatever Dave is writing about, the topic has a way, and the way he treats it, has a way of just conveying the humanity that's involved. It's unique. Certainly, you know, talent. Not every talented writer, I think, can boast that. Whatever you read, it is. You take personal meaning from. It's amazing. So Dave Hill this morning as well. Should be a good hour and 20 minutes. Second half at the races. Sirius XM back up here.
With Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Horsemen, nominate now.